Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Forget stocks, everybody. Bonds are where it's at. What Spanish debt and U.S. T-bills can tell us. What's wrong with fracking that a little marketing can't fix? And a little bit of Freakonomics Radio on the broadcast today from American Public Media. This is Marketplace.
Wake up to the day's top business headlines. Subscribe to the Marketplace Morning Report podcast. It's on iTunes and marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace podcast for Wednesday, the 30th of May. Glad you could be with us. We're going to begin deep down in the inner workings of the global economy, the bond market, and the overall state of things. In Europe today, the unwelcome spotlight fell on Spain. Greece had the day off, I guess. Spanish borrowing costs hit record highs, while not coincidentally, yields on American Treasury bills hit record lows. Marketplace's Heidi Moore in New York and Christopher Worth in London get us going today.
Our government, like most governments, runs on borrowed money. When you buy a treasury bond, you're not buying. You're lending. It's an IOU. You loan the government your hard-earned cash for 2 years or 10 years or 30 years, and Uncle Sam will pay you back with interest. So far, it's been a pretty sweet deal. People and corporations and foreign governments have lent the U.S. government $11 trillion at the latest count. They've never had cause to regret it, says Kathy Jones. She's the fixed income strategist with Charles Schwab.
People believe they're going to get their money back, it will be safe, that nothing untoward is going to happen to their money.
That security is why people will take a paltry interest rate of only 1.6% on U.S. Treasury bonds. It's a record low. But as my colleague Christopher Worth in London will tell you, it's the exact opposite in parts of Europe.
The interest rate that the Spanish government pays to borrow money rose to an all-time euro area high today, above 6.6%. Now, from an investor's perspective, that sounds like a pretty good return on your money. But Heidi, I spoke with Charles Dumas. He's with Lombard Street Research here in London. And I asked him if this is a good time to be investing in Spanish bonds.
Not unless you have an unbelievably strong appetite for risk. I mean, it is entirely possible that the entire euro structure will break up, so you've lost a lot of money.
He says that's because Spain has long been seen as this country that the rest of Europe really just can't afford to bail out. I mean, Spain has a high budget deficit that it's struggling to bring down. Its economy isn't growing. It has high unemployment. And now it's faced with trying to pump more money into a handful of failing banks. And Heidi, that's what's forcing Spain's borrowing costs to rise so high.
That's why a lot of investors just wish they could book a little flight for their money to get it out of Spain and Europe when things get tough. They call it the flight to safety. It always lands here in the U.S. Kathy Jones explained how it works.
Flight to safety means get out of the way. This idea that you want to go to the safest, most liquid market, liquid meaning you can get your money out anytime you want to.
Sounds like a great plan, right? But actually, we have a lot of problems here, too. Look around. We have high unemployment, the recovery is weak, and there's a risk that if the U.S. government can borrow at lower interest rates, it just gets hooked on borrowing. You can't go on like that. I mean, Spain's seen that, right?
I mean, everyone here realizes there's a limit to how long Spain can go on borrowing so close to 7%. It's just too expensive. Ireland and Portugal got into that situation, and they had to go looking for a bailout. Now, the question is, how does Spain back away from this sort of cliff edge, as it were? I spoke with Luigi Zingales at the Booth School of Business, and he says, first, Spain is going to need Europe's help in dealing with its troubled banks.
At this point, probably what I call a Europeization of the banking sector, which is different from a nationalization, but it's basically the same thing, but the Europe takes over rather than the local government, I think is probably the right solution.
But Heidi, the right solution last time, the trick that worked the last time borrowing costs rose so high, was when the European Central Bank pumped well over $1 trillion into the European banking system just earlier this year.
Yeah, and they never fail to give the Federal Reserve a call, right, when they have that plan. I mean, the thing is, we're all in it together. If the euro breaks up, we're going to feel it here, too. So the U.S. is watching this really closely.
Marketplace's Heidi Moore in New York, Christopher Worth in London with another installment of the never-ending European debt story, which, as it happens, gets us to today's episode of...
What's up?
What's up?
What's up, Europe?
We go to Brussels, Belgium this Wednesday, the political center of the European economic story. It's the headquarters of the European Union. Martina Stevis covers the EU for Dow Jones. And Martina, it's good to have you with us.
Great to be with you.
So what's the big story in Brussels today that's not in the papers? What are you guys talking about?
Well, I'm afraid it is in the papers, or actually it's not in the papers because of our time zone difference, so it's not in the papers quite yet. But the big story, as it has been for the last 2 years, is the crisis and what they're going to do about it. It's pretty much muddling through on and on, as it has been.
Is Brussels a little bit like Washington in that there's that inside the beltway mentality?
Absolutely. I mean, I've never lived in Washington, but I speak to colleagues who live there and cover the Hill and cover the Treasury. And it really feels like the same type of place, a kind of place of self-selection of officials, politicians, and the feeling that no progress is being made when it should be made, especially at a time that's so critical like it is right now for Europe and for the euro.
Yeah, how's morale? I mean, this is kind of a sideways question, but if what's happening over there were happening over here, you know, back in the financial crisis, things were miserable here. Are people depressed about it?
People are definitely depressed about it, more so in some places than others. I go to Athens a lot for work. I was born and raised in Athens. I can tell you firsthand that the mood in Athens is absolutely horrible. But of course, Greece is an extreme case. That said, any conversation you'll have with fellow Europeans, even in Britain, which has its own currency, doesn't use the euro, everything revolves around this crisis and concerns about the future. The uncertainty is really taking its toll. And I think you can see that even, you know, reflected in conversations you'll overhear at a bar or a cafe, but also in indicators like consumer confidence.
Martina Stevis with Dow Jones in Brussels. Thank you.
Thanks.
All right. So back here in the U.S. on Wall Street today, well, lousy would be a good word. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The marketplace ticker symbol O of the day this Wednesday trades on the NASDAQ as RIMM. The Canadian firm Research in Motion makes the once mighty BlackBerry, which is now a distant third to iPhones and Androids. And partly as a result, RIM is now predicting layoffs and losses. It's brought in two big investment banks to help with, quote, a significant transformation, according to its CEO. Clearly, the company is trying to figure out what's next, and that could be something that made the BlackBerry a household name to begin with, as Marketplace's David Gura explains.
A couple of years ago, you might have had your heart set on an iPhone, but your company gave you a BlackBerry. Well, there's a reason why IT departments have been so fond of Research in Motion, or RIM. Even as other smartphones have gotten more secure, tech analyst Jeff Kagan says RIM still has them beat.
It's a more secure network than anything else that's in the marketplace, including Apple iPhone and Google Android and all the rest of them.
But one of Research in Motion's biggest problems, Kagan says, is it hasn't emphasized that enough. RIM tried to catch up to competitors by going after consumers, and by doing that, it lost its base, business. Now, as Research in Motion tries to reinvent itself to stay in business, Kagan says it has an opportunity to get that base back.
The need for that security is more important than ever.
Especially as carriers move to 4G. That faster network means we'll use wireless devices to send and receive more data and more sensitive data, and companies will want that protected.
It's a great opportunity. Nobody has really captured it, though.
Matt Thornton agrees. He's with Avian Securities, and he says Research in Motion should recognize its future is not in smartphones. It should focus on software and security.
Then you're licensing out the hardware to someone like a Samsung, who is good with scale, good at manufacturing, good at product design, and let RIM do what they're good at.
What Thornton says it's always been good at, keeping data secure. I'm David Gura from Marketplace.
So private equity is one of those things a lot of us have heard of, but maybe haven't spent too much time thinking about. Until probably this year's presidential campaign made it practically a household term, what with Bain Capital in the political mix. So in what you might take as a sign of the times, one of the biggest private equity firms out there, it's called the Carlyle Group, is doing a little message control. It launched a new website today with a kinder, gentler image of what they do. From the Wealth and Poverty Desk, Marketplace's Chrissy Clark explains.
You've probably never been to Carlyle.com, and until yesterday, there wasn't much reason to. But now, one of the first clicks you can make will take you to this video. A guy in a hard hat says what he'd do if someone from the private equity firm showed up at his construction site.
If we could get him here, I'd shake their hand. I'd say thank you very much for, number one, the opportunity, and for, number two, let me work.
That's exactly the kind of feeling Chris Ullman wants to inspire. He directs global communications for the Carlyle Group. He says with all the scrutiny on the industry right now, he wanted to get the word out that all they do is invest money in companies to make them better and then sell them for a profit.
This is a perfect time for us to actually embrace this scrutiny and then demonstrate to the world, you know, what we've been doing for the past 30 years.
But it turns out they also had a very particular audience member in mind.
An archetypical left-of-center environmentalist in Montana.
Why, you ask? Last year, the Carlyle Group bought a water company in Montana, and he says there was a lot of public outcry. So I called up one of the outcriers.
And would you consider yourself a left-leaning environmentalist who lives in Montana?
Yes, I guess that's part of my identity.
Ermina Harold looked at the website, and her verdict?
It appears to be sort of greenwashing a little bit.
For now, that might be the best private equity can hope for from its entrenched critics. I'm Chrissy Clark from Marketplace.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, here you go. Political gridlock in Washington is over. No, it's not an agreement on taxing or spending or the national debt or education or immigration or health care. No, it's the bison and a pitch to make it America's national mammal. Marketplace's Adrian Hill reports.
Sure, bison are big, but who knew they were so powerful?
What's really exciting about bison is that it is one of those issues that really brings our country together.
John Calvelli is with the Wildlife Conservation Society. His group is part of a coalition working to get the bison elevated to the status of national mammal by pushing a Senate bill that's got sponsors on both sides of the aisle.
This is really a conversation about symbolism, and do we believe that the bison should be a symbol for our nation?
The bill won't cost anything. It simply names the bison the national mammal. And why do it, other than giving the bison a little respect? Bison have a good tale to tell. Robert Brown is a professor of wildlife conservation at NC State University.
Bison are somewhat of a success story. They were saved when they were down to 500 or so left.
Now there are herds of these things, a lot being raised for meat. And what would making bison the national mammal do for ranchers?
Time will tell. I mean, some people may not want to, may feel different about eating a national mammal.
Larry Higgins raises bison in Colorado. He guesses that if bison get the national mammal prize, it'll be a good thing, as we'll all spend a little more time thinking about bison. As for whether or not the animals have the temperament to be a national symbol.
Well, they can be a little ornery at times.
A lot like our politicians. Sounds like a perfect fit to me. I'm Adrian Hill for Marketplace.
Used to be that if you wanted to drill for natural gas, you went out and did some surveying, you found yourself a big underground reservoir, you put up a drilling rig, and you were in business. That's what people in the energy industry call conventional drilling. Kind of implies there's unconventional drilling too, right? Well, there is. It's called hydraulic fracturing, or fracking. And as it becomes more widespread, it's pretty clear that fracking is going to need a makeover. From Red River Radio, Kate Archer-Kent reports.
Researchers at Louisiana State University found that the Bayou State is more likely to support drilling if certain words aren't used.
Fracking has an undeniable similarity to a certain other four-letter word that starts with F that we won't specify.
Michael Klimek developed the questions for the LSU study.
We thought, would residents be more supportive of fracking or be more likely to think fracking is safe if we describe the process without actually using the word fracking?
Klimek took the scientific approach, but I wanted to test his theory on the streets of Shreveport, Louisiana.
Whoever came up with a good word, but most people don't really understand, you know, what it means.
I've never heard of that word. Ever. So I just learned something, so thank you.
It sounds a little dirty and nasty and impolite for mixed company, and it sounds really aggressive.
You just heard from Gary Backert, Heather Krask, and Sarah Hebert. The LSU survey went out to 731 Louisiana residents. Researchers specifically used the word fracking with about half of the sample group. For the other half, Klimek says, they described the drilling process like this.
A way to extract natural gas that involves using a high-pressure injection of water, sand, and chemicals to remove natural gas from rocks deep in the Earth's surface.
When study participants did not hear fracking in the question, they were far more likely to feel the process is safe and that the state should encourage drilling. So what does a marketing guru think about this image dilemma? David Placek created names for household products like Swiffer and Febreze as the CEO of Lexicon Branding. Placek thinks the term fracking is problematic for the natural gas industry.
The root of it is fracture, and that's just not a very positive thing. Whether there's a fracture in a political party or you fracture your arm, it's just nothing but negative connotations.
Placek calls to mind some frack history. It's found on another galaxy in the TV series Battlestar Galactica.
In 5, 4, 3, 2, 5!
Turns out Battlestar Galactica characters use the word frack as an expletive. It's caught on with sci-fi fans. You can order frack t-shirts online and download frack ringtones to your phone. Placek says this presents a PR challenge when it comes to the drilling process, especially in the media.
The press is just picking up on something that was used years ago. It's easy to say, it's quick, and I think in the right situations might even be, you know, used playfully, right? What the frack is that?
Michael Klimek at LSU hopes to run this survey nationwide. David Placek says the natural gas industry should call the process by its given name, hydraulic fracturing, and then come up with a new term once the drilling technology evolves. In Shreveport, Louisiana, I'm Kate Archer-Kent for Marketplace.
Coming up.
Nah, I don't need glasses to see. Nah, glasses is just fashion.
The Freakonomics of fashionable eyewear. But first, let's do the numbers. Wall Street gave in to nagging jitters over Europe today. That pushed the Dow Industrials down 160 points, 1.25%, 12,419. The NASDAQ surrendered 33 points, which happens to be exactly what it gained yesterday for a decline of 1.2%. The final number there was 2837. The S&P 500 pulled back 19 points, not quite 1.5%. Don't get superstitious on me here, but it closed at 1313. Stocks with global exposure suffered some of today's biggest setbacks. Alcoa shares tumbled 3.5%. Caterpillar stock dug down 2.5% today. Crude oil prices fell more than 3%. Energy stocks hit the skids as a result. ExxonMobil, Chevron, and ConocoPhillips all saw share values drop around 2.5%. Apple kept its shine. The stock rose more than 1%. Government bonds started looking more attractive, as Christopher Worth and Heidi were telling you. Prices rose. The yield on the U.S. 10-year T-note slipped to 1.62%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Show Marketplace how much you like us. Stay connected to our hosts, reporters, and top stories on Facebook. Find us at facebook.com/APM Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Thursday. In Washington, the Commerce Department releases the gross domestic product for the first quarter of 2012. The Labor Department reports on weekly jobless claims. And President Obama welcomes former President George W. Bush and former First Lady Laura Bush to the White House for the official unveiling of their portraits. I'm Gina Delvac.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdal. If you haven't heard it yet, here is the economic and political buzzword that's going to be a near constant refrain coming out of Washington, D.C. this fall. Fiscal cliff. The idea that if the Bush tax cuts expire at the end of the year, as they are supposed to, and automatic spending cuts from the budget deal last fall happen at the end of the year, as they're supposed to, that'll mean very bad things for the economy. The Congressional Budget Office and many others say so. So commentator Robert Reich says, let's do something about that.
We now know austerity economics is bad for weak economies facing large budget deficits. Much of Europe is in recession because of budget cuts demanded by Germany. And as Europe's economies shrink, lower tax revenues there will force their debt loads proportionately higher, making a bad situation worse. The way to avoid this austerity trap is to get growth and jobs back first, and only then tackle budget deficits. The U.S. hasn't yet fallen into that trap, but it could soon. We could slide into a new recession early next year if the Bush tax cuts end as scheduled on January 1st, and if more than $100 billion is automatically cut from federal spending, as required by Congress's failure last August to reach a budget deal. Predictably, Capitol Hill is deadlocked. Democrats refuse to extend the Bush tax cuts for higher earners, and Republicans refuse to delay the budget cuts. If recent history is any guide, a deal will be struck at the last moment, during a lame duck Congress sometime in late December. And it will only be to remove the January 1st trigger. Keep everything else as it is, the Bush tax cuts as well as current spending, and kick the can down the road into 2013 and beyond. Which means no plan for reducing the budget deficit. I've got a better idea, a different kind of trigger. Instead of a specific date, make it the rate of growth and employment we should reach before embarking on deficit reduction. Say 3% growth and 5% unemployment. At that point, the Bush tax cuts automatically expire. The wealthy pay a higher rate, and $2 trillion in spending cuts begin. This way, we avoid the austerity trap that Europe has fallen into. And we get on with the long-term job of taming the budget deficit when the economy is healthy enough to do so.
Robert Reich teaches public policy at the University of California, Berkeley. His most recent book is called Beyond Outrage. Take a second to share your thoughts. Marketplace.org is our website. You can find me on Twitter, if you like, at Kai Rizdahl is what you look for. Time now for a little Freakonomics Radio. Aww. It's that moment every couple of weeks where we talk to Stephen Dubner, the co-author of the books and the blog of the same name. It is the hidden side of everything. Dubner, good to have you back.
Great to be here, Kai. I don't know, with the L.A. teams out of the NBA playoffs now, I don't know if you're still paying attention or not.
I am so done with the Lakers. This is where the hate mail from L.A. comes in. But I mean, come on, really? Get over yourself.
Well, there is a trend, besides the demise of the Lakers, that is unmistakable, but it's a trend off the court. It's something you see during the post-game press conferences, and that is that just about every star player, LeBron James and Dwayne Wade, Kevin Garnett and Kevin Durant, they're all wearing these big, chunky black eyeglasses, you know, the kind that Urkel used to wear, depending on your time frame, you know, Buddy Holly.
But that's right. I guess it was LeBron I saw at a press conference from Miami, yeah.
There you go. Now, in the old days, it was pretty uncommon to see many athletes wear any kind of glasses. So my first thought was simply, hey, you know, maybe poor eyesight is on the rise. So we reached out to Susan Vitale. She's a researcher at the National Eye Institute, and she has looked at the rate of myopia, or nearsightedness, among Americans in the early 1970s and then again in the 2000s.
So in 71-72, the prevalence of myopia in people who were aged 12 to 54 was 25%, or 1 in 4 people. And when we applied those same methods to the later population, we found that the prevalence was 41.6%, which is roughly a 66% increase.
So that's a lot, right? 66% in 30-something years? Are we just getting older, or what's going on?
Well, you know, the causes are the subject of a lot of debate. Some researchers think it's all the close-up work we do, like reading the myriad screens we're tethered to. Others think it's because we don't get enough sunshine. Whatever the case, we asked Miami Heat superstar LeBron James if he actually needs those glasses to see.
Nah, I don't need glasses to see. Nah, glasses is just fashion. It's about fashion. If you wear them right, sometimes they look good, sometimes they can not look so good.
He's faking, man. He's wearing non-prescription lenses.
As millions of Americans do each day, we learn.
Really?
Probably about 4 million. You know, they're called planos, or glasses with plain lenses. Yes, sir. Yep.
That's I don't understand that. Well, he is so cool that he can look cool wearing glasses. I don't even know.
I think that's about right. The fact is, this trend has blown up all over the NBA, the NFL also. I asked the Harvard economist Roland Fryer about this, and he suspects, as only an economist could suspect, that this is what you'd call a two-audience signaling mechanism.
Well, okay.
These guys are saying to one audience, hey, I'm here, I'm an athlete, to the other one, look at my glasses, look at the way I'm dressed, look at the way I carry myself. I can promote your product.
Oh my God, that is so cynical. That's horrible, right?
Well, it may be much more than that as well. Even Roland Fryer says that. Fryer has also studied the acting white phenomenon, right? Which is when black kids who study too much get called out by their peers, yeah. as if there's a stigma in trying to accomplish too much. So now, with all these black NBA and NFL stars wearing their big nerd eyeglasses, it may be that they're sending a message that the acting white stigma is over, or at least that it should be over. Hmm. LeBron's teammate Dwayne Wade told us that he doesn't need his nerd glasses either, but he does like the message that they send.
Yeah, it is cool. You know, you try to go out and you talk to kids, you try to let them know that it is cool to be smart, it's cool to be educated, you know? So it's a message behind the madness, you know?
That's actually great, message behind the madness. It's acting smart is not acting white, right?
That's exactly right. Although I will tell you something very interesting. Roland Fryer, who's also African-American, told me that even he, a Harvard econ professor, that he wears glasses that he doesn't need in order just to relax everyone, as he puts it. And I should tell you this also. The signaling at Harvard doesn't end with eyeglasses, according to Fryer.
A couple of years ago, I was talking with one of my colleagues here at Harvard, and they said to me, they confessed, let's say, to me, that they dyed their hair gray. And I said, why would anyone do that? And he says, well, I want people to take me more seriously.
Wow. I will never understand people. Can I just tell you that? What about
you? I understand you, though, Kai. I understand you.
Stephen Dubner. Freakonomics.com is the website. We'll see you in a couple of weeks.
Thanks for having me, Kai.
All right, man.
Freakonomics Radio is supported by Novo Nordisk. Since 1923, committed to diabetes care and areas of unmet medical needs at novonordisk-us.com. Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note, today in which it somehow becomes possible to feel sorry for Mark Zuckerberg. Zuckerberg and his wife are honeymooning in Italy, where the Italian tabloid press has made much of the brand-new billionaire not being able to figure out an Italian ATM machine, to which I can only say, come on, he's on his honeymoon. Give him a break, will you? Jeez. All right, that's it. We're done. That's Marketplace from APM American Public Media on this Wednesday. Today, the Dow sank 160 points, about 1.25%. The NASDAQ gave back all 33 points it gained yesterday, 1.2%. The S&P 500 declined 19 points, not quite 1.5%. Ravi Karman, Chris Clark, Stephen Colon, Bradford Craig, Bill Lance, Jeff Peters, Charlton Thorpe, and Brendan Willard engineer the broadcast for us. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you back here tomorrow. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.